Hello, I'm Mariëtte Snyman. Welcome to Calm, Clear and Helpful, a weekly podcast series on taking good care of yourself and others, introducing you to a wide range of wellness professionals ready to inform and inspire. Today we're looking at how to navigate the natural stages of your love relationship. My guest is Dr. Ingrid Artis, counseling psychologist from Johannesburg. Welcome back on the show, Ingrid.
Thank you, Mariëtte. It's lovely being with you today.
To our listeners, I do hope you'll excuse me for sounding a bit hoarse. After our conversation, Ingrid will give us her three tips on baking a scrumptious sourdough bread, and then it will be fun question time. Ingrid, do tell us about the work you do.
Okay, Mariëtte, I'm a counseling psychologist and I'm based in the Roodepoort area, close to Clearwater Mall. And I direct a private group practice where we do counseling, we do career guidance testing, scholastic testing. But my personal interest is actually to do therapy from a brain-based perspective. So I'm very interested in the brain. And I'm particularly interested in understanding how trauma can impact how our brains are wired in order to cope. So what happens often is we have these coping strategies that are not always optimal and that can lead to relational distress and even in intrapsychic problems and things like depression and anxiety. But what's really wonderful about the brain is the fact that it's neuroplastic, meaning that we can learn, it can adapt, it can grow, it can change. And that makes therapy possible, of course. And then we can develop these healthy neural pathways, patterns of behavior. And I use this as a frame of reference when I work with individuals, but also with couples, couples in distress. So I do work a lot with cognitive behavior therapy, and also brain working recursive therapy that I know you also quite fond of.
Yes.
in terms of your previous discussions with people.
Yes. And if I'm correct, then working with neuroplasticity means that change that people might not have thought possible, that actually becomes their reality.
Yes. So human beings are highly adaptable. We can learn new information particularly if we're intentional about learning. That is why they say therapy is something that you cannot be forced to do. You have to want to do it. The brain likes to learn through motivation, positive feedback. So if we see where we can go and we can see the end goal, it's easier to navigate towards that. But if we're resistant and we don't really want to change, then therapy can be counterproductive. So the beautiful thing about the brain is it's teachable, and we can learn, grow, and develop as we intentionally focus and want to change, basically.
Now, today we're talking about romantic relationships and how understanding the typical developmental stages can help us achieve lasting love, which I think is what many of us deeply desire.
True. So, Mariëtte, if we understand that it's both normal and it's desirable for our relationships to move and to mature through these developmental stages, and these stages, by the way, are similar to those that we go through in early childhood development, then it actually becomes more possible to identify where our relationships could potentially be stuck. So one of the purposes of intimate relationships is actually personal growth, believe it or not. And it's not just because it's nice. It's so that we can develop ourselves as people. So this growth is normally accompanied with some level of discomfort, like any growth often is. And as we move from this comfort zone, so where we are currently, to deeper maturity, it might actually be very uncomfortable for some people. But for other couples, this growth is a process that's quite natural. It's not very difficult. It's comfortable. But the couples that we often deal with, then they find the growth process very anxiety provoking, very unpleasant, and that's why we want to develop healthy boundaries and a healthy sense of self and a healthy sense of worth, self-worth and other worth. And we even want to develop a healthy growth mindset where that actually just means that we're curious, open to learn. So as we spoke about neuroplasticity now, we want to become more flexible, brain flexibility, where we open to think about the world, ourselves and others in new ways. And even resilience, which means that I can do this, I'm able, I have what it takes. So if we have these traits, we tend to move more comfortably through the relational developmental stages. And what's interesting about these stages, they are quite predictable. For some, they're just a little bit shorter. It's quicker to move to maturity. And for other couples, it's a laborious, difficult process. But lasting love is a mature love. And where we value both the individual, the I, in that relationship, but we're also able to enjoy and value the we, the us, the togetherness. So it's both the I and the we is valued, and we don't feel threatened by being in one or the other state. So, you know, building these mature relationships are possible, but if we understand we have to go through predictable developmental stages, it then becomes a little bit easier to navigate this development to maturity. It's not as terrifying anymore because it's not strange, weird, or unusual to be in a particular stage.
Yeah, so what you do is basically you provide a map.
Yeah, that's right. And like a GPS on a map, you can get a sense of where you are at the moment, right? Mm-hmm. And if you have an understanding of, oh, that's where I am in this developmental stage, that explains why we're doing what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And there's hope that we're going to move, hopefully, into the next phase towards maturity. I think that helps to move away from a pathology model rather to a growth model in terms of couples development, where couples aren't seen as there's something wrong with me or something wrong with us, but we are simply normal developmental stage that might be a bit uncomfortable. We're not quite sure how to navigate our way through on this map, but it's possible. And so a therapist will just come along with couples to help them to navigate their way through to the next stage of maturity.
Ingrid, I know you believe that the way we moved through typical developmental stages in childhood influences our romantic relationships. How does this work?
So, Mariette, in psychology, many researchers, psychologists have looked at various aspects of development, for example, moral development or cognitive development. But people like Margaret Mahler and Bowlby, they looked at relational development from birth up to around, let's say, around about 3 years. And so what I want to do now is run through those stages with you so that we can create a bit of a foundation to understand the parallel with childhood early development and then the developmental stages that we have in our relationships, because they're similar. Mm. And so you will be able to see as I describe these early childhood stages, and when we look at the adult stages, how they are very much the same in the processes that we have to move through in order to move to the next stage. So that first stage is normally from birth to around about 5 months, and it's called symbiosis. And that's that initial bonding stage, which is very much driven by oxytocin. I think we all know oxytocin is that hormone, that bonding hormone, that is that initial attachment that we have with our primary caregiver. But let's say primary caregiver is mom. When mom learns to tune into the baby's cues, she actually becomes a very effective caregiver. And there's a good bonding process that happens. And in this stage, the baby is unable to see itself as separate from mom. So if you think about it, this makes a lot of sense, because when babies in the womb, they're literally part of another person's body, or at least they're inside another person's body. Mm-hmm. So there's this intricate connection for 9 months. And then we have the birth process, which is this massive separation physically. But we can maybe say then that cognitively, the baby has to catch up to that idea that I'm not part of mom. I'm a separate entity. And that's what the next few stages would really be about, is this idea of separation, individuation, that mom is mom and I'm myself, and that we're two separate people. So we can say then from around about 6 to 9 months, we start to define our boundaries. And that's where babies start to recognize, hey, mom, the caregiver is different, separate from me. And that stage is also called differentiation. And as baby starts to recognize the mom as a unique, different, unique individual, mom is not the same as somebody else. And they can literally identify mom's face from between other people. So it's a very important stage as an initial separation stage to go through. And then from about 10 to 17 months, we call it the practicing stage or the exploring stage, where baby enjoys that excitement of moving out, exploring the world. You can imagine that's when baby starts to learn to walk. And they start to touch everything, and they're crawling all over the place, putting all kinds of stuff in their mouth. It's an exploration stage, and they're kind of developing this sense of self. I am not so much part of mom anymore. I can kind of expand my world a little bit and move out and be curious and try new things, literally, when they put things in their mouth. And that's a very important part of self-development. And then at about 18 months, there's a stage called rapprochement. So that is a French word, I believe, which actually just means back and forth. So if you think of a cha-cha dance, it's moving forward, towards, and then back again. And this is when baby pushes for their own independence even more. So that's typically the terrible two stage, right, where toddlers would insist, I want to lace up my own shoes. And they're very adamant to do things independently. But they also still have a very strong need just to be babies sometimes. And they regress into wanting to be taken care of their parents, where mom, you know, mom is still that soft place to fall, and they still want to cuddle. And so it's this movement between seeking own independence, doing things by themselves, but also having that connection. And then up to about 3 years, children go through this phase of developing object constancy. And this idea is very important when we think about attachment theory. So I'm just going to explain to you what object constancy means. So it's simply that ability to hold on to the caretaker's image in our mind, even if that person isn't present. So there's a model of mom, let's say, in our brain, in our fantasy, in our imagination, even if mom is not around. And this internalized image can be very soothing, to be able to walk around with mom with us, you know, mentally, even if she's not around physically. So when we have that ability to have our primary caregiver mental image internalized, we can self-soothe ourselves. Even when we're feeling somewhat frustrated or disappointment, we can still maintain a sense of attachment, because that person is an internalized construct. So when babies or children, when they're still very cognitively immature, they maintain a sense of safety by looking for close proximity to mom, their primary caregiver, especially in stressful situations. So that closeness is what gives them a sense of peace and calm, and a calm and a compassionate and a rational, responsible caregiver would actually model self-regulation to this child and would also assist co-regulation. So what's interesting is when babies are born, just the interesting side note is that the heartbeat of the mom is a calming sound to them because they've heard that sound right throughout the pregnancy process. So there's this calming effect as they move close to mom. Even children who need special intervention, just putting that baby on mom's chest where the chest can regulate temperature, for example, which is a fascinating idea that the mother can regulate the baby's temperature perfectly by just putting baby on her chest. So there's this regulation and the mom is able to help that distressed child to calm down. So what happens then over time is this baby develops feelings of safety, trust, connection, and they start to develop a sense that my caretaker is reliable. My mom is reliable. When I have a need, my mom meets my need. So we feel loved, we feel cared for. And this then becomes a template for our relationships in adulthood over time. So what I've explained now is what we would call a secure attachment. And this is linked to having these positive models, both of ourselves and other people. So obviously we would see mom in a positive light because mom looks after us, she cares for us, I'm worthy enough for her to look after me. And we also see other people as good and trustworthy. So a model of ourselves and others when we have these secure attachments is I am worthy, or I'm good, you're worthy. And you'll see as we carry on our discussion how important just having these models would be in terms of how we see people and how we see ourselves. So I'm going to quickly also speak about these four important attachment styles, just so that we can get an understanding of what happens in early childhood years based maybe on parenting styles and how we then attach potentially to our caregivers, which then in later life affect our attachments in adulthood. So we spoke about the secure attachment, which means we have these attuned caregivers. We can regulate our emotions. Yes, we might be distressed when our parent leaves the room initially, but we are able to be calmed down quite quickly. And in adulthood, people with secure attachment styles can manage conflict quite well. They can self-soothe themselves, so they can regulate their emotions much better. And their perceptions of themselves and others are positive. They walk around with what we would call the positive perspective, which, of course, makes trust one to another much easier. Now, there are three insecure variations of attachment, which I'm quickly going to discuss with you. And they are often linked with that initial bonding or lack of bonding. So the avoidant type are often children who've been neglected or abused. And basically what happens is they develop an over-focus on themselves. So they feel they are good, but the caregiver or others are bad. So in adulthood, I'm good, you're bad. That's the internalized model of how we perceive people. And so what you see in childhood is these children are not actually distressed if parent leaves the room. And they actually manage their anxiety by avoiding or ignoring their parents on return. Because they've been neglected or abused, there's almost a learned helplessness that starts to kick in where it's like throwing your hands in the air. Even if I do cry or ask for connection, they will be dismissed. They would be neglected. They will not be acknowledged. So in adulthood, we see adults who are typically very independent. They tend to withdraw. They minimize their feelings. Well, actually, the feelings of others. And they tend to engage in more casual relationships. So they struggle to go really deep. And the way they tend to resolve conflict is by walking away or having ultimatums, or they might even show aggression and lack empathy. So the childhood experiences definitely impact the way that they engage with others in their adult relationships. And then we have the anxious or ambivalent type, which has an overfocus on other people. And you would imagine then that their model would be, you're good and I'm bad. So the internalized model of self and others. And they tend to get very distressed when a parent leaves the room in early childhood. But when the parent then returns, they might kind of punish the parent for leaving with an overt type of anger. And the reason for this is these parents are usually either partially available, very limited in their availability. They're just not really present. They're not always there. These children they basically have a strong need for connection with their parents, but sometimes they're there, sometimes they're not there. It's very unpredictable. Now, in adulthood, the way we would see this is these adults tend to avoid conflict, and they resolve the conflict often by submission. They really crave close relationships, but what they tend to do is they push other people away. So they struggle to trust, and they need constant assurance from their partners. There's often underlying feelings of anxiety, and in these relationships, jealousy might even be common. The last type that we're going to look at here would be your disorganized, fearful type, and these children have usually childhoods where parenting was very inconsistent, unpredictable, but also where this double bind dynamic would take place. So where parents would set up their children to fail. Now, as a side note, James Lange was a psychologist in around about the 60s who did a lot of research on schizophrenia, and he did a interesting study where he theorized or postulated that people who develop schizophrenia often have parents who have this double bind type of interaction where they would give children mixed messages. For example, you never hug me. And when the child moves forward maybe to hug the parent, they say, oh, no, it's too late. Or they'll criticize the child. So they technically set that child up to fail. And that's a horrible, horrible situation to be in. And sometimes even what happens here is with abuse, as we've discussed in the previous style, the child is seen. But what happens with this disorganized style is the child might not even be seen or recognized or noticed. So they don't have a sense of self. They're not seen to exist in some way. So what happens in adulthood is the adult might feel very confused in intimate relationships. They don't have a sense of steadfastness, or they don't quite know how to understand relationships because they themselves feel unworthy. And they might tend towards aggression or antisocial behavior or maybe even depression. They are fearful, impulsive, confused, and they your personality types have very, very poor self-regulation. They struggle to regulate their emotions. And it's really because they're stuck in that frozen state. So we spoke about fight, flight, and freeze. So the fight state is that avoidance style. The flight state is anxious, ambivalent. And then we have this organized, fearful style, which is the freeze state, where that self is frozen. In a sense, they couldn't really develop. And these adults that actually don't have object constancy, they are not able to carry the other person or a model of the other person in their minds as an internalized idea. And they tend to view relationships as dangerous. So that would be our four attachment styles in a nutshell, just to give a little bit of a foundation and understanding.
Thank you, Ingrid. So I suppose when you're working with a couple, then you would look at these attachment styles.
It's very helpful and meaningful to get a sense of what people's attachment styles are. And I think it's also helpful for couples to have an understanding of what their attachment style is so that they can grow towards a more secure style. And that is possible. And that is where relationships actually is very valuable, because we can have these corrective experiences in our adult relationships one to another.
And can we now take a look at the stages through which love relationships typically develop?
Yes. So the development model, or the developmental model for couples, is developed by psychologist Ellen Bader and her husband Peter Pearson. And they postulate that couples move through similar developmental stages as children do. Right. So we spoke earlier about symbiosis. So that first stage that a couple will go through is also called symbiosis or bonding. And those of us who've fallen in love before, we can relate to this. This is that limerence infatuation stage. And in this stage, we merge boundaries. So we kind of get lost. Our sense of self gets lost in the we. And we put our partners on this pedestal. It's difficult to see them as anything being wrong with them. And it's a wonderful stage to be in, because there's a lot of oxytocin that is released, dopamine, serotonin, all these wonderful feel-good hormones. And as we know, oxytocin is our bonding hormone, so there's a strong sense of connection. There's a strong sense of belonging, which is, of course, one of the deep needs that all of us have, is a sense of belonging. We are social creatures. But it's not a terribly rational stage, so we can't see the red flags when we're in this stage. But the function of the stage is important. It's so that we can develop that sense of we as a couple. It develops a very strong foundational bond, like a glue, that's very important. And it's also a stage where we start to explore our shared values and our shared compatibilities. And so we feel a very nice sense of, we found this person that just gets us, they understand us, and we feel very, very loved in this stage typically. But that stage doesn't last forever, and it takes about 2 years, the first 2 years after symbiosis, we start to move into the differentiation phase. So that is when we start to move away from each other again. Not necessarily moving away all that much, but we start noticing, hey, actually we're not merged. We are not this one ball. We are two different people. And we start to revisit our own thoughts and our own feelings, and we start taking our partners off their pedestals, and we start seeing them more for who they are. And we start to develop the stronger sense of self again, where we recognize our own desires. And this recognition of each other's differences might also cause problems, of course, because we might feel, hey, but you're not quite the person that I thought you were at this point. But if we're able to successfully move through the stage, we can also learn to manage our differences and to resolve our conflicts, which is important for mature relationships. So essentially, this stage is about learning to tolerate our differences, to recognize them, to maybe even value them, and then to manage our anxieties around just being different, to being a unique person. So it's a very, very, very important stage for us to learn to walk through and to tolerate. Now, if you remember, we spoke earlier about babies moving through the exploration phase, where babies start to realize that they can explore the world and they can walk and put things in their mouth and be a unique little entity. So the same thing happens in the next phase with adults, and that would be, well, they call it the exploration phase or the practicing phase, and that's where we start moving back from that we, us as a couple that's together most of the time, to an I. Now we're moving back again to our sense of individuality and self. And actually, in this stage, the I starts to dominate more than in any of those other phases. And we start to focus more on our careers or hobbies, our parenting. We might even have separate friends. And as horrible as this stage might sound to some people, it's actually a very important stage that we have to work through. It's a stage where we develop a solid sense of ourself as actually being ourself as being from the relationship. And that is important for the next phase, which we'll look at, but that healthy self-esteem gets developed as we explore the world, as we try new things, as we maybe engage in our own hobbies, as we maybe develop ourselves in our careers. We develop a sense of self-esteem that is very important to have healthy relationships, actually. Now, the next phase or stage is the reconnecting phase, which is that rapprochement, which we spoke about, the back and forth. And this is a stage that's already much healthier. This is a more mature type of stage where we start to move back and forth between ourselves as a couple, the we, and then we move back into the I. But we move close and away, really like a dance. And there's a sense of being comfortable for both parties in this movement back and forth. It's a sense of security in that it's not terrifying or scary like the exploration phase might seem. And so the couple spends more time together again. Often in this phase, there's deeper sexual connection, maybe a more loving kind of sexual connection. They tend to develop security and trust one to another more, where we tend to allow our partners to make decisions on our behalf. So that speaks about deep trust. And we tend to even give to our partners, even if it does seem inconvenient to us. So it's a very loving stage to be in. And that basically the stage is about the me and the you and the us can actually all coexist. And it can actually be strong. And we can have all these aspects of the relationship, me, the you, and the us, without feeling as if one part undermines the other. And as I mentioned, the importance of a strong sense of self. So this stage actually becomes quite a bit stronger if we have developed a strong sense of self. We know who we are. We know our dreams, our hopes, our desires, our feelings, our emotions, etc. And now the final stage, which is really those couples that we all look up to, that look like they've made it in the world, that's the synergy stage. We have this mutual interdependence. That's technically where one and one is bigger than two. So that is the two individuals together is a powerhouse in the world. And they are able to integrate intimacy into their ongoing life and even in joint projects. So these are the couples who make things happen. They wise and they do things to leave a legacy. They might start interesting community projects together, etc. So that's really those mature couples that many of us look up to. And then just as a side thought, I was thinking of an author called John Powell, who wrote a book called Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am? He wrote this in the 60s, and the answer that he gave can be summed up as followed. Because if I tell you who I am, you might not like what you see, and that's all that I have. So many of us are fearful to expose who we truly are one to another. And we see this in these earlier phases, right, where we're not comfortable, we don't fully trust our partners yet to expose who we fully are and truly are. But when we have these mature relationships, we are more comfortable to share our stories, our thoughts, our dreams, even if they might not be all that comfortable for our partners to hear, our partners have developed such a sense of regulation that they can handle it. They can listen to us and they can basically be in that discomfort together with us and allow us to be who we are, the good, the bad, and the ugly. So those are basically, that's a summary of Ellen Bader's developmental stages, and it's important to have a meaningful, deep relationship.
A quick note on what I do. I'm a content entrepreneur creating podcasts and articles on living a happier and healthier life by interviewing coaches, therapists, and other wellness experts from over the world. You'll find this content on my website, www.mariehetsneyman.co.za, and it's there to help you find just the right helping professional when you need one. The section Up Close and Personal on my website offers you a glimpse of the person behind many of the experts I feature. If you're a wellness expert keen on getting more in-person or online clients or creating worldwide awareness of an issue close to your heart, let's talk about co-creating a podcast or article or perhaps featuring you in a South African magazine. You'll find more information under Services on my website. Now, back to my guest. What gives rise to conflict between relationship partners?
So Ellen Bader says that problems arise with couples when they use all kinds of coping mechanisms to prevent that differentiation from taking place. For example, couples might find the exploration phase very scary, and then they might start controlling their partners so that they don't go and explore their hobbies, for example. So couples typically don't come for therapy when they're in the rapprochement, reconnecting, or synergy phases, those last two phases. So they tend to come mainly when they're stuck, and the stuckness might be in that symbiosis phase. And what happens is when a couple becomes stuck in symbiosis, they can actually be either a hostile dependent type of relationship where there's overt aggression or even covert aggression, which would mean that passive aggressive type of responses. That's how it manifests. And here we can see this is like more of a fight response again. If we think about trauma, fight and flight. So this is a fight, hostile, aggressive type of response in our relationship, which is really because couples have anxiety. They're fearful of their partner differentiating. They're fearful of moving out of that symbiosis stage because it's very comfortable and warm and fuzzy. And when their partner starts to develop and grow and move into a new phase, that might be experienced as very threatening. And they then use strategies like control to prevent that from happening. Of course, that would backfire because most of us don't really like to be controlled, right? And then another way that it manifests could be the conflict avoidance style. And these couples tend to present as very friendly, or they might have these tension-filled type of relationships, but they actually emotionally very disengaged. There's underlying blame or there's denial, but because of this disconnection, they even have a poor sex life. They're not very interconnected with each other. And what these couples tend to do is they What they blame or what they tend to organize themselves around would be some type of external symptom. For example, it's the depression that's the problem. Or, you know, our child, we've got this problem child. That's the problem. So they don't really look at the relationship as something that needs to develop and grow. They look at these external symptoms, let's say. And that's where that denial manifests. So it can be very tricky to work with these couples, especially if there's that sense of denial. And the reason why these couples are stuck is due to chronic failed differentiation attempts. So they struggle to develop themselves and to mature as individuals. And that is often one of the major goals for therapy, is to help couples and the individuals in a relationship to be able to learn to express their needs, their desires, their own thoughts, to develop themselves as individuals, to mature as individuals, because if we do that, we can develop mature relationships. But it could also be, and so that's typically a symbiotic stuckness, but people can also be stuck in different stages that can cause trouble. Like they can be stuck in a symbiotic and a differentiating state. So one person wants to remain the we, while the other person wants to develop themselves and they want to express their individual desires, etc. And this can create a strong sense of anxiety, particularly in the person who's in the symbiotic stage, and frustration perhaps for the person who's trying to differentiate. They might feel maybe annoyance with their partner who just wants to be in the we, and they might feel that their partner's already too clingy, maybe too controlling. So it's a very uncomfortable situation. So it's quite difficult when couples are in different stages. And some couples might be in, one partner's in the symbiotic stage or the other is in the practicing stage, and the person in some symbiotic stage wants to remain the we, where the other one wants to go explore and do activities and meet up with their friends. And that can be very threatening to many couples, especially as they see it as not being a normal part of development. So if we are unable to notice that this is natural and normal for us to go through stages, it's threatening. And it's this idea that my relationship is a threat that activates that hindbrain, that fight or flight freeze response when we start to behave in strange ways in our relationship. So that's just a quick summary of potential reasons why relationships get stuck and why they struggle.
And how do you help couples who experience difficulties in this regard?
So, Mariette, when a couple can recognize where they are stuck and they can learn ways to help themselves to cope with this discomfort with the growth, there's often usually anxiety that's underlying this, then we can move towards helping couples develop the skills and the tools to move through those stages. So typically the goal of therapy would be differentiation, to teach couples how to express who they are, their needs, desires, one to another, to help couples to see that they are unique individuals and that it's okay. They are allowed to move through these different stages. So we work mainly on differentiation of oneself, but also differentiation from the partner. So what that means is differentiation of self is the ability to identify and express our important aspects of ourselves with each other, which would be things like our thoughts, our feelings, our wishes, and our desires. So you can imagine if we're able to do that, we as individuals start to mature, or we start to develop psychologically, because now we can start to learn how to put these feelings, thoughts, wishes, desires into words. And not only in our own heads, we need to learn to express these, and we need to learn how to make our needs known to our partners, that it's not this invisible need that we have and we resent our partners if they can't fulfill it, but we learn to actually express it openly. So it's moving through potential anxiety of being known, as I mentioned before with the book, Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am? So now we're kind of confronting those type of fears, and we're helping and assisting couples to learn how to express who they are. And another aspect is to learn to differentiate from our partners. So that would be developing this ability to be curious about our partner's self-disclosures while we even manage our own reactions to that. So it's not always easy to get to know parts of our partners that might be difficult to get to know. And we want to learn how to be curious and how to even manage our own reactions, our own emotions, so that we eventually develop this ability to maintain a congruent image of our partners over time for who they really are, if that makes sense. So our partner now is not a fiction of our imagination. We don't see our partners through the lenses of who we would really like them to be, and they don't always live up to that standard. But we see them as a real person who's human, who's fallible, but we value and respect and love them regardless of that. So we learn to love the real person as opposed to false images of who we think our partners should be. And that, of course, is very important, because when we have these low levels of differentiation, couples, either one or both partners will collapse in themselves. And that could develop things like depression or disillusionment in the relationship, disengagement, and that, of course, is problematic in relationships.
Ingrid, when does a couple need professional help?
So we've mentioned now some of the areas of stuckness that couples can experience. So when there's a sense of stuckness, we're not moving forward, and that often manifests in conflict. So the conflict being this hostile dependent relationship that we looked at, or a sense of disengagement, which is a conflict of avoidance style. So when couples notice that they're really struggling to get along in a healthy, engaged way, and these very strong emotions that's underlying the relationship and dominating and ruling that relationship, then it might be helpful just to seek a little bit of help to move through these developmental stages and to get unstuck, essentially.
And do some couples need individual counseling as well as couples therapy?
Yes, you often have couples who present with individual traumas that may have to be addressed. And these individual traumas can have an impact on relationships. So one of the main traumas that we often see that can change the dynamic of a relationship would be a traumatic loss. So if one in a couple might have lost a loved one that was very important to them, and they're struggling to process the loss, and they can't go through a grief process by themselves, that might be a good reason to do individual sessions. And sometimes it's just traumas, even childhood traumas that might still play itself out. We've now spoken about childhood attachment problems, and these early attachments can really have been traumatic for people. It might have informed their childhood experiences. So one can use therapies like BWRT to help couples just to navigate through those traumas to make it easier for them to focus on their relationships in a more adult way in the here and now.
Where can listeners learn more about your work?
So we have a website called West Psych, so Direction West, PSYCH.com. People can find us on Facebook as well under that name. And we've recently launched a YouTube channel where we will be doing little tips or discussions on psychological topics. And it's also under the same name, WestPsych.
Thank you. I will attach the link to your website to this podcast, and the other information will be in the podcast notes.
Okay, great.
Now we've come to your tips on baking a scrumptious sourdough bread.
Okay, so I learned to make sourdough bread last year sometime, and since then I've been baking a sourdough bread maybe once or twice a week. So this has become part of my life. And it's a wonderful bread type. If you enjoy bread, this is the best bread possible. It's a very simple ingredients. It's simply just your flour, water, a little bit of salt, and then you have your sourdough culture. Now, my tips would be, if you want to make a wonderful sourdough bread, you need to use rye flour to make your leaven. The sourdough culture really thrives on rye flour. It's the best food for your culture. And then another tip is to place a steel pan with boiling water in the oven so that dough can remain moist enough on the surface so that it can keep rising. So if you want your bread to rise beautifully, keep a pan of water in the oven, and only take it out, let's say, the last 15 minutes or so that the outside of your bread can become a bit crispier.
Now, Ingrid, sorry, is that then a separate pan of water?
Yes. So what I would normally do is I put my pan of water on the top rack.
Oh.
Because it protects the top crust part of my bread so that it doesn't burn. So it has that function as well.
Mm.
It's just a normal stainless steel pan with boiling water. You put that in. You can put it in earlier while you're still heating up the oven, and then you put your bread with a, you know, another tip, I guess, is you can take a cutting board with a handle and use that to slip your bread into the oven. It's much easier. And then it's a good idea to invest in bread baking equipment and tools. Like, one of the important aspects of baking sourdough bread would be, for example, a banneton, which is like a basket that you use to proof your dough in the fridge overnight. And this overnight proofing is actually very important, because that's when your bread starts to develop that wonderful flavor. You bake bread at a high temperature, about 230 degrees. So if you proof it overnight in the fridge, obviously your dough is going to be cold. And that is okay, because when you put cold bread into a hot oven, it expands. So that helps with a rising process. And, you know, just something else that I've purchased recently, which I quite enjoy, is a little mini stone flour mill. So that means I can even mill my own wheat berries. So I make my own flour from organic wheat. So my bread is probably as fresh as it can be. And it's really, really nice to eat. Sourdough bread is healthy as well.
Oh, you are making my mouth water.
Yeah, I should maybe give you a bread one day when I see you in face to face again.
Yes, I'll hold you to that promise.
Yeah.
And may I ask you a fun question, please?
Yes, let's go for it.
If you could be drifting in a hot air balloon right now, Ingrid, anywhere on earth, which landscape would you love to be looking down on?
That is an interesting question, because there's so many beautiful things that we can see. I would imagine drifting along a beautiful coastline where we have mountains on the one side, a beautiful coral reef on the other, the coastline, and just beautiful white sands. And maybe some waterfalls in the mountains.
Ooh.
Sounds a bit like Cape Town, actually.
Beautiful. Thank you. And thank you, Ingrid, for taking the time to explain to us so much about relationships, which can really help us navigate our romantic relationships more easily. Thank you.
You're welcome, Mariette. And thank you to the listeners for taking the time to listen.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that to our listeners. It was really good of you to join us. And I'd be honored if you'd subscribe to this podcast series where you download your podcasts. Please remember, if you found this episode insightful, share it with someone you care about. Go to my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, for this episode's podcast notes and for free articles and podcast episodes on how to live a happier life and have more fulfilling relationships. To follow me on Facebook, just search for Mariette Sneeman, journalist. Calm, Clear and Helpful is compiled, hosted and edited by me, with original music by Marthe-Marie Sneeman. Catch you next Tuesday at 9:00.